If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, I'd take back those words that hurt you, and you'd stay.
In the immortal words of Cher, who is also immortal, what would you do if you could turn back time? And in this episode, this book, really, it's not an episode, it's not a TV show yet, give us time, we actually get to answer these questions about what would someone do if they could turn back time, except the problem is that that power is in the hands of a Yurk, which is never where you want that power, named Visser IV, who takes our kids through a journey through history and just shows them that they don't know that much about history.
Visser IV is kind of bad at this. Like, this is not a great plan. Has he never seen a time travel movie, like, ever?
Probably
He's
not.
An actor!
That is true. That is true. He is an actor. He really, yeah, he should have seen a time travel movie.
Every single piece of media revolving around time travel tells you why you can never do it in the way that you want to. Like, why it's not going to work. And this doesn't work at all.
Yeah. And yet, he does throw the kids for a loop through a lot of it. Not a time loop, though. So it does bear stating, to start the book, it's really confusing at the beginning, because unbeknownst to the reader, we begin in an alternate reality. So Tobias starts this off and is like, yeah, I'm Tobias, I'm a bird, I like flying, the usual. And then he mentions somebody named Melissa, and you're like, who the hell is Melissa?
Especially since he talks about wanting to hold her hand and kiss her.
That's not...
Excuse?
Yeah, that's not Rachel. So that's confusing, and it's just a little thing to make you go, uh-huh, typo? And then at the end of this the chapter, he mentions seeing the slaves down on the ground, and then that's another moment where you're like, what? Rewind, Tobias? Say again, please? What? So eventually you get these clues, and you put them together and realize that our kids are not really our kids. It is some version of them in a different reality. And it's worth talking about because it's scary as all get out when you really start to pick the clues apart and get like a bigger picture of the world that they're living in, which is also kind of a fun exercise. And I do really like the way that the ghostwriter put that together, because I'm pretty sure this is ghostwritten. I don't think this is K.A.
Yeah, I do like this ghostwriter a lot. When I was a kid, I was a history nerd. As an adult, I'm less of one just because I have a job now. So reading this as a child and being like, oh yeah, traveling through history and trying to figure out like where they were going to go and why they were there, what was going to happen, and like how things would unfold in the future if like these things didn't happen was like my jam utterly.
Agreed.
And I think the ghostwriter does a good job.
I agree.
Not only putting together a totally chilling future, but sort of stringing together major events from Western history, largely, and thinking about how what would happen if they hadn't happened the way that we know them to, like World War II.
Exactly, I agree. And I was also kind of a history nerd as a kid, well, because we were best friends, so that really should tell everybody everything that they need to know. But I do remember that my favorite computer game at the time was not Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, but Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego, which was awesome. If there are any other 90s kids who played that game, and I should state that technically I'm an 80s kid, but you grow up in the 90s when you're born in the 80s. So, yeah, if you had Where in Time as Carmen Sandiego, that was awesome. So
You were like the second person with a computer that I knew. And we'd sit in your room and play it and just be total dorks and be like, I remember an instance where I was like, oh, they're in Spain because those are leprechauns on our horses. Oh my God. Like,
what a smart kid you were.
And oh, they're in Denmark because look the way that O is shaped. I read that in Number of the Stars.
See, this just proves that you were a very intelligent child.
It was a great game. They should re-release it. I would play it in heartbeat. There's probably a sim for it online. I don't know.
Yeah, let us know. If you have any information about the whereabouts of Where in Time as Carmen Sandiego, the whenabouts, let us know. Hit us up, because we're also still history nerds who like to read about time travel. So
The Dino Time Travel Megamorphs is great. This Time Travel Megamorphs is great. Like,
yeah.
I'm here for it.
Me too. I will always sign up for an Animorphs time travel adventure. Especially when the present time, the alternate reality, is so concerning. So let's talk about some of the things that exist in this world that are a little bone-chilling. Besides
slaves.
Melissa. Yeah, slaves is the big one. Melissa's really kind of like a small fry when it's all said and done. And you do wonder if it is Melissa Chapman. And then you start to wonder how exactly.
I think it is because they say something about Cassie being Melissa's best friend. So, like, we have, and then, so I assume that she sort of just, like, that the druid would have taken somebody that they already knew and just, like, inserted her to make it seem, like, less bizarre at first. Instead of just, like, random person that we don't know at all.
Yeah, and it also, this is a very big question, and it's kind of dumb that I don't quite know the answer to this off the top of my head, but in this reality, they're not animorphs, right? Like, would they be fighting the Yurks? And then they're all still best friends hanging out in Cassie's barn?
I don't know, this is established, though. Because
Jake
goes off on his psychotic dictator, like, mind rant about radicals, he thinks about the consequences of having to turn Cassie in for radical tendencies, because the Yurks had infiltrated the Triple S. And so, like, if he had to turn any of them in, then they would all be shot to hell.
Thank you.
So it is really a hellscape.
Having paid attention to what you read. I don't remember that part.
You remember the Triple S, though.
I did. Well, I was thumbing through the book when I saw the phrase Triple S, and that was how I remembered, because I read it instantly. Anyways, so there is a Triple S, which Diana joked earlier that because the SS wasn't enough, they had to add another. I don't know what it would stand for. Although SS stood for something in German.
Schutzstaffel shitheads.
Yeah, I like it. So there is a sort of oppressive government body or governing body with the Triple S. And they talk about, Jake says that his dad is a patriot of empire. So there's definitely like a twisted nationalism gone wrong kind of thing happening. And they talk about Cassie being subversive. They have slaves, and Cassie has slaves, but she's never, like, she's always very nice to them and kind of lays low and doesn't rock the boat because, you know, it would stand to reason that bad things would happen to her if she did. Which,
yeah, it seems like, I think, like, it's established or indicated that in this reality, like, slavery isn't based on skin color the way that it was in actual U.S. history, but on, like, intelligence and ability, because there's, like, mention of people with lower IQs being enslaved. So it's like, oh, okay, we swapped one for the other. Awesome.
Yeah. We evolved. Okay.
Yeah.
And we do get an example of what happens to somebody who is subversive, because that is the reason why Rachel isn't there. Rachel has been whisked away to a re-education camp because Rachel would not go quietly in any instance. That wasn't something that she fully believed in. And they also make mention in this part, as well as later in the book, that both Jake and Rachel are half-Jewish. Or half-Jewish? Well, Rachel's at least half-Jewish. I guess you could say that Jake might be full both sides.
Well, I don't know a lot about Judaism. Doesn't Jewish descent come from the mother?
I thought so, yes.
Regardless, it's stated that being Jewish or being African American or probably Latino or anything else that isn't white makes you automatically suspect of, like, being in this version's reality of the Black Panther Party. So
yeah, so Rachel is off being re-educated.
Well, she's
scary.
Loud and violent. And,
yeah, she's,
you know,
she's a rabble-rouser. Yeah,
who's loud and violent.
Yes.
Sidebar, if you want to read about more non-compliant females, check out Bitch Planet.
Oh, a plug.
Yes, it's a great comic that just premiered. And it is specifically about Rachels.
God,
lots
I
of
love
Rachels.
Stories about Rachels. I love it so much. They also mention things like there's a war in Brazil, which is very interesting. And the sole purpose of the war seems to just be to kill native people, which they call primitives instead because they're super... racist like that. So clearly this alternate reality, the world is not okay. And when we finally get a hang of this, of course, who comes to visit, but Drode.
Crank's little toady guy.
Exactly. And he's there to tell them, like, that they can change all of this. And to tell them what's happening, and what is happening is that Visser 4, a low enough totem Visser that he's kind of lame and this is why he's doing it, but also a high enough Visser that he's, like, kind of scary. So, Visser 4 is a human. He's in a human actor's body, and he's going through history and changing things. And so what he's changing has caused this reality that they're in now, and they need to go fix it because no one likes this reality because it's terrible. And so they still have a debate about it, though, because there is one stipulation, there's one price they have to pay, which is the cost of a life. So they can go back and they can fix it, and they can set everything how it was, but it will cost them one of their lives. And immediately Marco says no deal, because he knows that the life will be Jake's. And he doesn't want to go around messing with history and lose his best friend, which is understandable. But of course, Rachel wants to, like, beat his face in the ground and is like, did you hear about the slaves in the war in Brazil? Like, did you hear about that? Do you really want to, like, just keep going with that? So ultimately, it does come down to it that they all agree to go back and try and help, because how could they not? And of course, Marco's reasoning for doing it, the final oppressive governing nail in the coffin, is that there's only one TV channel.
Yeah, and earlier he'd been talking about how great Palm was, so it's like, okay. Oh, Marco, never change.
Not even in an alternate timeline did he change.
He was probably the most similar.
Yeah. I guess when you're sort of cynical and shrewd, that kind of sets you up to always be cynical and shrewd, no matter the situation. Like,
Rachel obviously hadn't changed much either.
That's true. So they accept their mission, and they immediately get whisked back in time, and this is where the fun stuff begins, because it's history adventure now, and not really concerning oppressive future. The first place that they find themselves is in the rain, in a muddy medieval battlefield, which is totally where you don't want to go in history.
No, medieval times has never appealed to me.
Nope.
People didn't bathe. Yep. Actually, the amount of time devoted to how unhygienic the French and English are,
I love
is,
it.
Is delightful. Like, Marco really goes into detail about lice.
Yes, I love how descriptive they are about how gross everyone was back in the day. But I feel like it's important. And especially visually, that is not communicated in movies and TV shows, because visually you don't really want to see that. But in the pages
of a book...
Yeah, like,
I'm watching The Tudors, and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers looks great, like he always does, and he's super buff and clean and has a waxed chest, and, like,
no.
You had, like, an ulcerated wound on your leg. You probably smelled terrible. You didn't brush your teeth. Like, come on.
In the pages of a book, however, I enjoy how much delight and
disgust.
Yeah, and disgust that was put into describing just how gross these people were. And it even turned out to be a plot point, because that's how they figure out how to figure out who is Visser 4 in this whole bunch. I believe they use the word skanky. Figure
yes.
out which person is not skanky. Which maybe has changed definitions a little bit from 1999 until now.
Marco especially uses the word skanky to mean, like, unclean or unwashed. Like, at one point he describes a skanky alley cat, and I'm like, it's a cat! Like, you can't make any moral judgments here, man. Like, oh wait, you meant it was dirty, it probably had mange.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, that's Marco's definition, which it works, I guess. So that's how they'd figure out who Visser 4 is, and they assume that they need to protect the king, because theoretically it would stand to reason that if Visser 4 is going back in time to make waves or make changes, that you need to make changes in larger power structures. So if you take out a king or someone very important, then theoretically that would change stuff. But they have no idea where they are or what battle this is, because it's medieval history, so.
Yeah. I remember being a kid and reading this and going, wait a minute, I don't know this battle. Why are they here? I was literally the same as them, because I was about the same age and knew slightly more about history, Western history. I was like, I don't remember this one. This isn't one of the big ones.
Nope.
So it's sort of like, you know, they don't know why they're there. They figure whatever John Berryman is trying to do, we'll just try to keep him from doing it, because he knows what he's doing.
Apparently
John Berryman is a history buff.
Well, I do enjoy the attention paid to keeping the kids in the dark about certain things, that they really are being yanked around at the whim and going in. And the ghostwriter specifically puts them in places that speak either French, English, or German, which are most likely to be understood by present-day Americans. But at the same time, like, you don't know the language, you don't know the culture, you don't know when you are, you don't know why you are there, you don't know where to go. And I think that that sense of disorientation is really fun and also realistic, the way that they put it through at the same time. So it does turn out later, they find out that they were at the Battle of Agincourt, which I have been instructed to say in a French accent.
You're the only one of us with a good French accent.
Ah, merci. So they're at the Battle of Agincourt, and the reason is that John Berryman, the human, is a history buff, and so his one stipulation for going back in time for evil deeds is that the Yurk make a pit stop in his one historical fantasy place, which...
I thought it was because the Yurk was so annoyed because he kept reciting Henry V, and he wanted to literally stop Agincourt from happening the way that it was supposed to, so that Shakespeare wouldn't write a play about it. It is the pettiest thing of all time, in all time, and it's beautiful because Yorks are like, seriously, dude, you took time out of your, literally, out of your giant evil plan with the most powerful weapon like the universe has ever known to go to Agincourt and stop Henry V from being written.
Yep. And his first stop on the trip, too. It was stop number one. It wasn't an afterthought.
Yeah, it was a priority.
It was. They eventually leave Agincourt. They spend some time nearly dying, of course, and getting stuck in the mud. And, of course, everybody thinks they're witches or sorcières, if you will. And
that's what happens when you morph into a horcrusier in medieval France.
Yep, which is kind of fun, actually, because I always just go like, what's that person going to tell everyone later on? And then what stories about mythical creatures that we know historically that are passed down through the ages, like what of them are just animorphs time traveling?
Yeah, because like when Tobias is a horcrux, he's in a church. And you're holding a pitchfork, man. Like, yeah, this is where devils came from.
Yeah. Or like the werewolf idea, which they call them a werewolf, so they clearly have the concept of werewolves before Cassie morphs a wolf. They have to follow Visser 4 through time. So when Visser 4 activates the time matrix, they get yanked with him, but they get yanked sort of separately and at different times, and they just appear randomly in the new timeline. So the next place that they go is in colonial United States, before it was United States. They go to the event of Washington crossing the Delaware to surprise the British troops. And literally what Visser 4 does is he goes back in time and warns the British troops that they're coming, which he also does again later in the book. And I like this idea that how Visser 4 is planning to change history is just to go back and be a tattletale. That's
He's
it.
He's seriously just snitching his way through major battles to change the outcome. Like, that's all he does. I'm like, all right, you can at least assassinate someone.
Well, it makes you question about, I mean, we've talked about this because we're nerds who talk about these things, but the concept of war, we always used to talk about when we were little, the concept of war is so weird because you meet on a battlefield. Do you like schedule it? Do you like call up the opponent and be like, well, we're gonna be here at this time, so we'll see you there, like bring crumpets? So it's something that is so weird about war, and it is well addressed in this book that the tiniest action can change a big event, and that a big event is composed of very small moments, but also people with a lot of power making small decisions, which is really interesting.
Yeah, like he could have, instead of going to warn the British and have them unleash the Hessians early, like he could have gone and like pushed George Washington out of his boat.
Yeah.
Or something.
Exactly.
Like that probably also would have done the trick.
Exactly.
And instead he chose to snitch, which is the lowest form of warfare, if you ask me.
It's true. Everything is just petty, petty, petty with this man.
It's a very petty Yurk. Like, just because it's established that like he was higher ranked, and then he lost the war on Lyra, and so he just like hates the Antwerps, well, the Andalites, the Andalite bandits. But he also hates his host. He hates everybody. He's just like really, really, really petty.
Yeah, he needs a cookie.
Like think big, and then he tries to think big and do this, and it's like you thought too big. Find a middle ground between stopping Shakespeare from writing a great play and, you know, altering the entire outcome of human history.
Yeah, seriously. So that's the goal in Delaware, or at the Delaware River, is to stop Washington from crossing the troops. Also, a fun little note here about of comedy is that they always talk about in history books, in American history books, that the troops, Washington's troops, didn't even have shoes in the snow, and so they would tie rags around their feet. And of course, the Animorphs don't have shoes either, because they're in their morphing outfits. And so a delightful bit of detail is that Marco steals George Washington's boots out of his tent, I assume, to keep his feet warm.
If anybody's going to have a spare pair, it would be the general.
It's
true. I think
it's
fair.
Yeah, it's fair game.
My favorite small portion of this chapter is something that I still say on occasion, if occasion gives me reason to, which is Guido Washington. Because they're like, oh man, it's George Washington. And Rachel's like, be George Washington? And Marco's like, no, Guido Washington. What does that even mean?
So, it's not all comedy and fun and games in this chapter, though. Something very tragic happens. Because the British troops have been alerted to the Americans' attack, as they are crossing the Delaware, the British open fire on them and basically kill everybody. And they also, they put a bullet through Jake's forehead, which is very explicit, I feel like, for this book and for Animorphs to talk specifically about gun weaponry and being shot in the head, literally.
And what happens after you're shot in the head. Not by, a modern gun, which would be bad enough, but by a musket.
Yeah.
Colonial weapons were terrible. And it's actually a miracle that the United States happened, because, how did not everyone... Even if it wasn't, a mortal wound, your doctor would kill you. It's just really bad. And
yeah.
So at some point, it's mentioned that, oh, yeah, the back of Jake's head is missing. It's gone. It was blown off. Because that's what happens when you're hit by a musket ball. And so, and Marco's sitting right there. So.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's fantastic.
So they find out that the price has been paid pretty instantly, pretty quickly in the journey. And they blip to the next place. Because Jake's body is thrown overboard. And Cassie is in the river in a dolphin form, and they tell her to try and get Jake's body so that they can take it with them, but she can't find it. The whole river is overrun with bodies, and it's a really horrible moment. So they don't have any control over when they leave that time period, and so they leave the time period, and they don't have Jake with them. And they end up on a ship in the middle of an ocean, which is basically doing battle with another ship. And it turns out they're at the Battle of Trafalgar, which is where Lord Admiral Horatio Nelson defeats...
This is Dr. Trafalgar's favorite.
This is a little more my wheelhouse. Defeats Napoleon, not for the final time. No, for the final time. Because Waterloo... Wait, which came first? Was it Trafalgar or Waterloo? Which one's the final one? So I don't... Actually, this is not my wheelhouse.
I don't know either. I mean, I don't know how it's... I'm just like the Animorphs. I don't know how it's supposed to happen in history. But it is established later that after they lost at Trafalgar, they had to make peace with Napoleon. So I'm going to assume if they had won at Trafalgar, Waterloo was the final battle, but they lost.
I think you are correct. I think Trafalgar is when the tide turned. It was a major decisive battle against Napoleon, and his troops were weakened, and then eventually they did him in at Waterloo and then sent him to Elba.
Isn't that why, Wellington or the other one, Earl of Waterloo after that or something?
Probably. Yeah, probably. That sounds like something the Brits would
do. Things we used to know.
We were total history nerds. What are you talking about? So this is the Battle of Trafalgar, another decisive battle between the French and the English, who, according to this history book, seem to be fighting all the time. At the Battle of Trafalgar, Visser IV is still there, and again, at this point, it's pretty chaotic, because they've just gone through three wars in one fell swoop, and they lost Jake, and... They assume that they need to kill Visser IV. That's kind of the sum of it. So Rachel goes after him, and in a monkey morph, and she is actually blown in half by a cannonball. So we lose another one pretty quickly. Cassie doesn't participate in this at all, because she is kind of having a...
Post-traumatic stress?
Yeah, that's a good thank you for that phrase. Because I didn't want to say having a problem, but she can't cope with what just happened. And she was in dolphin morph anyways, and when she went from water to water in dolphin morph, it was a lot easier to stay there and not deal with the pain of losing Jake when she has the dolphin's mind to sort of keep her out of that black hole of sadness and trauma. So Rachel gets blown in half, which does not help anything. And then Tobias and Axe are trying to get to Visser 4. I'm not even sure where Marco is at this point. And then they jump again, and they follow Tobias to the next time period in history, which is more academic-seeming, less war-seeming. And Tobias finds himself in, like, a boys' dormitory, and he's able to pick up a history book, which is very helpful for his purposes, and it tells us, A, that he's at Princeton University, and B, he's no later than, or no earlier than 1934, because that's the publication date of the book. And then not only that, he is able to read some of the history book, and that's when we get a lot of our information about the Battle of Trafalgar and Washington crossing the Delaware and what those outcomes, how those outcomes were changed and what that meant for present day Princeton 1934 history.
It would be really weird to pick up a history book and see an index listing just for rebellion American. And, like, just a line about it.
Yeah.
Like, because that's all there is, because it failed.
Yeah. It would just be a footnote. But whereas in actual, you know, in history books now, you devote a whole section to the revolution, the American Revolution, and the founding of these United States.
This is where, for me, things get a little, like, and I think for the book, like, intentionally, things get really sticky, because you're like, all right, okay, we're in North America, which is not called that. We don't know what it's called. There's not an American flag. There's a flag that has a British Union Jack and, like, a pale blue color. No clue, other than that it's still owned, probably, by Britain. And people are still super, super racist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is, like, the first thing after Tobias's history lesson that we find out.
Yeah.
Because Cassie appears.
Cassie appears, and apparently, when a black girl appears in an all-white boys' dormitory in 1934 Princeton University in a really bigoted alternate universe, it's not great. So we are treated to some racial slurs, which of course aren't written out.
The guy's called Davis, which is funny.
Yeah, that guy. Also, there's somebody else whose last name is...
a direct descendant.
Probably. Well, there's another guy whose last name is Friedman, which I thought was kind of funny. Like Friedman.
Is it spelled like... like Freed, or is it spelled like Marty Friedman?
It's spelled like fried.
Yeah, I mean, based on what we know about the droid future that the kids start off in, I'm going to assume that Friedman is a radical because he's Jewish.
Hmm. That could be. Well, he is the nicer of the two.
Yeah, he's the nice one. He's the one who says, don't use the N-word, you're not in Alabama.
Yeah.
But I think this is worth discussing because it begs the question, when did this country that is not the United States end slavery? Have they ended slavery? Probably not.
Yeah.
It's possible that there are freed slaves, or that, you know, or freed people, or people who were born free, and Cassie's, you know, looks like one of them who lives in the North, the way that that happened in the U.S. history. But, you know, in our history, Britain freed its slaves before the United States did.
Yes. Because that's so something that's interesting if we... because slavery in America is sort of a distinctly American thing, and it was distinctly shaped by the geography of the colonies and things like that. And if the United States never became the United States, and if we're under some sort of British rule or extension of British rule, then what does that mean for slavery, like you said?
It's interesting to ponder.
It is. And it's worth mentioning... what happens in a little bit is after Princeton, they shuffle through history really quickly. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But one of the places that they land, they talk about a battle on a grassy hill. And the way that they describe the fighting and the uniforms, when we talked about it, it sounded a little bit like the Civil War. But
uniforms.
Yes, but what it stands to begs the question, what kind of civil war would still happen in the United States if there was no United States?
Send us your thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. If you have any ideas, if you are a history buff,
talk
please.
Talk about us.
Yeah, please.
Talk about this with us.
Let us
talk
pick
about
your
how
brain.
You think this would unfold.
It's really fascinating. The whole sort of endless possible timelines and alternate universes and things like that. And they get into a discussion about that in the end, which we'll talk about when we get there. So in Princeton, when Cassie arrives, things escalate really quickly. And Cassie actually kind of pulls a Rachel. And instead of just you know, letting the water roll off her back, as it were. She morphs a polar bear, since the guy wants her to be white, and then eats his face, more or less.
She sticks his head in her mouth.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, which is a very Rachel-like action, which, at this point, they think that Rachel is dead, that they've lost another person in their group. However, Rachel walks up behind them, and so they realize that the sacrifice of one of their own is only a sacrifice of one. So now that Jake has been sacrificed, none of them can die. Or at least that's what they think. They don't want to test the theory. But of course Rachel is the one that tests that theory. Inadvertently, but still. They also have a realization at Princeton, when everybody sort of comes together, that they have to sort of take power into their own hands. So it's not enough to just kill Visser 4. They also have to take the time matrix and go back in time and fix everything. So every place that they've been, they have to go back and ensure that everything is right. Which is a tall order. And when I read that, I kind of looked at how many pages we had left in the book and was like, how am I going to do that? But at that point, it's kind of a power shift, and the Animorphs become more aggressive and more sort of knowledgeable about their mission and what they need to do. And as such, Visser 4 tries to lose them, which is why he goes through several points in time really quickly, which we'll talk about. The first one that he hits is just a maul. So,
trying to think if there have ever been like any significant
maul events
in a maul. Anyway, they don't have time to do any shopping, much to Rachel's dismay.
Exactly. So the second one is an empty desert at twilight, which could be a whole host of time periods. Presumably something in the Middle East, which is topical recently in the last 20, 30 years, and also topical in sort of biblical times.
Or even World War II.
Or even World War II, that's true. After the empty desert, they do go to someplace recognizable. Of course, Marco kind of bungles it at first, but they're in ancient Greece at the Parthenon, just for a brief minute, just to see it, say hello. And then the last one is the battle on the grassy slope that we talked about that could possibly be the Civil War, but we don't know. They mentioned having long shotgun rifle things over bales of hay as a barricade on like a grassy slope. So,
kind of mid modern warfare.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say, as a non-military historian.
Military historians, write in. Let us know. There's so much knowledge that needs to be had for this book. So finally, Visser 4 decides on a place, and he picks a very big, decisive battle. But the thing about this one is he picks one that's more recent in history. It's kind of one of the more recent, big, decisive, big history book things, which is D-Day. But because it only happened, well, when this book was written, what, 55? Almost 60 years previous. All of the things that he screwed up in the timeline beforehand had affected D-Day. And that was the same in Princeton as well. We didn't mention he's at Princeton because he wanted to kill Albert Einstein before... No, not kill. What did he want to do? Oh, take the
bomb.
No,
I'm totally disapproving of that.
Oh, okay. I thought you were shaking your head. I was like, what did you want to do? I guess it didn't matter about Einstein. He wanted to take the bomb. Which, that is kind of the big thinking, you know, not like snitching on sneaky soldiers.
He literally only needed to do that.
Exactly.
That's
it. All.
He didn't have to do anything else.
No.
Like, that would have totally changed modern history, which I think it's established in the Intellect Chronicles, the Yorks are invaders until the 60s. So, he would have been set, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So he...
But Einstein isn't in Princeton, where he's supposed to be.
That's part of the problem, is that he is not at Princeton. He is still in Germany.
Presumably.
History knowledge test.
This book is an indictment of the American public school system.
It is. I feel shame. I feel shame for what I don't know. And I'd like
both
to
of us took AP history classes.
I know. We both learned things in the past. We were history buffs as kids. My favorite game was Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego. And yet. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Exactly. It's a nice history refresher, this book. And also Google. So they're at D-Day, which, of course, is the decisive battle that swung the course of World War II. It was not easy, of course, and so they're there and at the beach. All of them are in different places. Marco kind of has the worst luck on where he
gets
placed.
He's really good about landing in boats.
Yeah, he lands in one of the water. They have a name for them, some kind of fish-related expression to talk about those watercraft that the tanks were being brought in on, and he was in one of the first ones that hit the shore, which. Again, even in actual history, those guys didn't stand a chance, the ones who hit it first, because I think the Germans did have some idea that they were coming. However, in the alternate universe, Visser IV gives them like a major head up, so they're heads up, so they're basically massacred. And Marco is immediately trying to just save his own life, even though theoretically, if he were hit by a bullet, he would survive.
He'll have lots of times to be hit by more bullets.
Exactly. Well, so he morphs a fly to be able to not be hit, which...
I probably would have gone for cockroach.
Yeah, I was thinking
that
as well.
They don't have a sense of smell.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is he talks about he picked fly, which has a sense of smell, and when there is burning flesh and blood in the water, it's really not what you want to be smelling. So, Axe lands up on the beach, and Axe has, like, a big crisis at this moment, because we kind of are skipping over a lot of the big parts, but there are certain points in history where they have sort of a big, moment where the author allows them to process everything. And for Axe in particular, Axe brings up a lot of good points about being horrified by the human species, and how much infighting there is, and they explain to him about World War II, and Rachel brings up the Holocaust, and Axe is like...
He thinks the Jews were the opposing army.
Yeah.
Which
and,
is a fair assessment if you're an alien.
Exactly. And Rachel was like, no, it was just genocide. They killed children. And she even brings up... I felt a little surge of pride about Rachel in that moment, because she not only... She talks about... Jews
she
being subject
to people who were killed.
Exactly. She mentions intellectuals and she mentions gay people.
And Roma people. And
yeah.
Lots of people.
So thank you, Rachel, for that. And thank you for letting us know for the first time that you're half Jewish.
I mean, we haven't really had a Christmas book, so.
No, or a Hanukkah book. But now we want one.
An option for
we want a Hanukkah book. Axe is sort of mortified that he was like, well, Andalites have never killed children. And it is something the Animorphs has addressed before, that humanity is capable of great things and also really horrible things. And you can ask the question, why do the Yurks want to infest humans? Humans are terrible, but at the same time, humans are very capable. And and the way that so many sci-fi novels treat other species is very sort of discordant with how... humans are as a species, because you talk about the Andalites and it's, oh, Andalites are very proud, Andalites look like this, Andalites have this code of ethics, Andalites behave in this way, Andalites did this war, had this technology. If you look at humans, it depends on where you go that any of that could be completely different, and it's affected by things like power structures and sort of the worst of humanity, like greed and hate and intolerance. And these things that are sort of rearing their ugly heads in the book because of the way that the Visser IV is affecting history. And Axe has like a meltdown on the beach in D-Day.
Yeah, he thinks to himself, like, you know, this is not my war. These are not my people. I don't have any moral responsibility here. Like, I can run if I want. But he's Axe.
Yeah, exactly.
And then someone dies in front of him.
Yeah. And someone dies on him.
Some strength.
It dies on him, right? He's the doctor.
The doctor, like, falls on him.
Yeah, he sees a doctor run and save try to save a man who is surely dying. And then the doctor is also hit, and the doctor falls on Axe as he's trying to morph. Or maybe he's already a bird. Regardless, he's something small, and he has to morph to try and get this dead body off of him, which is really horrific. At D-Day, things are a little different. The defending armies... So, assumedly, the Allies are still some form of England, Englishy, American colony people.
Yeah, the soldier that, or whoever he is, that Marco talks to has an American accent.
Yeah, so it's something. Well, and that's the thing as well. So what exactly are they fighting about in World War II?
Yeah, nobody knows, because it's established that the whoever the kids land with who was invading Normandy, the force is striving against a mixed German-French force.
Exactly.
And you're like,
what? Quoi?
Why? So what is this about exactly?
Exactly. Like, and if the idea, I mean, it's possible that Pearl Harbor still happened. And that would
be
enough.
Yeah, we don't know anything about Japan.
Yeah, that would be enough to provoke the United States, or what would be the United States, to enter the war. And it's true, it is true that knowledge of the Holocaust was not there. Because my first reaction was, if America is so terrible and bigoted,
they wouldn't care.
Who cares that, yay Nazis, basically, at Princeton. And at the same time, though, it's important to understand that nobody knew of the Holocaust until Allied soldiers were discovering the concentration camps and realizing sort of what had been happening internally in Germany at the time. So it's very difficult to say if that was still happening, and especially because we have to talk about Hitler at this point.
Yes,
because,
so the big reveal.
Yeah, and so, well, that's the big reveal, is that Hitler is not at the helm of this. And so much of the big push of the Holocaust, it was spearheaded by Hitler. Hitler cultivated that and generated that, and it was the very focused beliefs of this one man who were able to make this happen. And that one man in this timeline is a truck driver.
Yeah, he drives the French-German captain's tank, and you're like, all right. And there are no swastikas, so it's like, effectively, there are no Nazis. There's, Nazism didn't happen.
Exactly.
Whatever D-Day, and, I mean, it might even just be a coincidence that Normandy is where they end up, because if you're fighting to invade France, you're probably going to invade Normandy.
That is true. Strategically. Geography doesn't change.
So, this is not D-Day as at all recognizably.
Exactly.
Happened.
And that's something that is also interesting about the way they deal with Hitler, because Tobias immediately sees Hitler and goes, I gotta kill that guy. Because his image, exactly, Hitler's image has been sort of seared into our brains as just this, like, haunting vision of ultimate evil. And Cassie, because Cassie is the sort of humanist in all of this, and I may not be using that word correctly, but you know what I mean. Cassie, the dolphin lover, and is the one that says, this man is a truck driver. The atrocities that you want to kill him for are not something that he has committed, and you can't kill someone for what they are. You can only kill someone for what they do. Only kill someone for what they do, but you can only hold someone accountable for their actual actions and not for who they are, or maybe even things that they say.
Yeah, because otherwise you get things like the Holocaust.
Exactly. Exactly. So thank you, Cassie, for that topical moment to sort of tie this all back around together. And meanwhile, Marco, Axe, and Rachel are having, like, this bird battle with grenades.
That's true. They're trying to blow up a tank.
They want to blow up a tank because...
With grenades.
Yeah, because theoretically, if you blow up a tank, and it's the first in a row of very long tanks, then you stop all the tanks. So there's Rachel, the military strategist. And as a bald eagle, and with Axe as a harrier, they get a grenade, and Rachel has it in her talons, and then Axe does, like, a drive-by pin removal.
It must have looked really funny. The soldiers have just been like, what are those birds doing? Why are there even birds around? This is a battlefield.
Exactly. So they manage to drop the grenade in the tank, and it turns out that is the tank where where Cassie and Tobias are, yes? Because, they're at a tank that's carrying the Time Matrix. It's like towing the Time Matrix. So regardless, the explosion that Rachel and
the whole point here, of course, is Visser 4. Visser 4 did go and tip off the French-German people,
of course.
But they were like, "We're gonna keep you around. because we don't know who you are or why you sound like that or how you know these things. So basically they have him handcuffed in the tank with the Time Matrix. So they're like, all right, we can't destroy the Time Matrix, obviously, but we can kill him.
Yeah. And that is what ends up happening. The explosion in the tank doesn't quite kill him because they have time to talk to him.
He's kind of blown
yes.
away.
And
funnily enough, they do kill Hitler.
Exactly. He was a casualty of this whole thing.
Yeah, it wasn't intentional.
But the other, so the what also complicates this is when they blow up John Barryman's body, they don't necessarily kill the Yerk. So the Yerk slithers out of his head, and they go, oh crap, what do we do with that guy? Because the evil is not the body, the evil is the Yerk. And so they debate leaving it there to starve from Candrona rays, which seems like a risk. It seems like you wouldn't do that. And it's Marco who has the shrewd understanding of the situation, and he picks up the Yerk and he throws it in a fire, I think.
Yeah.
And he basically says, like, well, if no one's going to do this, I'll do it because it's what needs to be done. So now that Visser 4 has been killed, they still have to go and fix everything that went wrong, that he messed up in the timeline. And Cassie has the sort of, I don't want to say genius, but the very smart, horrible idea, which is to ask John Barryman before he dies where his parents met. Because if they can prevent, theoretically, and we'll talk about this in a moment, theoretically, if they can prevent John Barryman from being born, Visser 4 won't wreak all this havoc. I feel like that is not entirely true, because again, the Yerk is different from the man.
Yeah.
They needed to ask the Yerk, where did his parents meet? And then go yeah. blow up that Yerk pool.
Sorry, we have to go Yerk diving, guys. Like, keep your... Because don't they, like, sort of like bud off? You have to keep the parent Yerks from doing that.
Yeah.
But... For the sake of going to San Francisco in the 1960s.
Yeah, why not, man?
Which is where Barryman's parents met.
Yes.
They travel there and have a giant argument about time travel in the middle of the street with a glowing orb. Which, if you're going to do that, it might as well be among hippies who are just going to think you're really cool.
Yeah.
Which is what happens.
Yeah. That is the most amazing thing. Because they get there and they're like, how do we do it? How do we prevent them from, like, meeting? And literally, they just spend enough time arguing about it that they draw attention to themselves. And Barryman's mom looks at them and, like, her dad, or, like, his dad walks by. And they just, that connection is never made. And that was enough. Because instantly, they flip back to the present. And they're like, wait, what? Did we do it? What happened? How'd that happen?
I guess it worked.
Yeah. And I also do enjoy that Marco points out that even with everything having changed, hippies still existed. Which is also interesting, because how, if in the present day, Jake would...
There would be no counterculture like that.
Exactly.
In that kind of country.
Exactly. So, interesting. Interesting thing that you put forth, book. But we say no. Cassie, of course, feels horrible about this. She sort of says that throughout this whole process, everybody's going to have one big sin. And I said just one. Which is the sad truth of the Animorphs series, and this is hers, is to prevent John Barryman from ever being born. So in that way, it makes me happy that he did get to see Agincourt, because he doesn't get to have a life instead.
Yeah. That was really sad for me. It's like, you know, Barryman doesn't have much going for him. He's not a good actor. He's enslaved. Like, if all he has is reciting Henry V to piss off his enslaver, then full steam ahead, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
There are definitely worse plays.
Exactly. And...
he starts reciting it before he dies.
Yes. Buddy. What's the other thing? Oh, Jake immediately snaps back as well. Oh, and the other thing that I wanted to mention is... and they don't... address this a whole lot, but I think they bring it into the fold, and after having read the whole book, it kind of gets you in like a gut punch, sort of, is Jake needs to be caught up, because last he remembers was being in the Delaware River, and so he says, did we make it all right? And Cassie says, no, we put it back.
The
Holocaust still happened.
At some point they, maybe when in the 60s when they're arguing about the Time Matrix, they argue about, like, whether it would be better to keep the timeline that they're in, because because the Holocaust didn't happen, and that's big, it's significant, like, it's a good thing that Hitler was just an old man driving a truck. And then, you know, but then they have to compare it to the timeline that they know will come out of that, in which, well, yes, okay, the Holocaust didn't happen, but there is a Holocaust going on in the not United States, basically.
Yes.
Like, they're killing Native people in Brazil, and they're killing their own poor and homeless people, and they're enslaving people who don't have a high enough IQ to meet whatever. So it ends up being 6 1/2 dozen of the other, pretty much,
yeah,
unfortunately. And I think they all, you know, they learn that time travel is not the answer, kids.
No. So, yeah, so all in all, I think this is a really excellent book, and it kind of has the sort of best of Animorphs, which there are hijinks and there is comedy and adventure, but at the same time, it is also really thought-provoking and doesn't cut corners on social commentary and also personal, on personally affecting these kids. Like, like we said, Jake's head gets blown off, like the leader of the group. So even amidst the sort of fun historical romp, we also have a lot of really horrible things, which is a pretty accurate, you know, definition of history. We did it. This is probably going to be really long.
Yeah, I mean, I always think that the Megamorphs are like longer books. They are a little bit, but not by much.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, when you talk about time travel, there's
so much to parse.
It's a conversation.
Exactly. So the next book on our list of books to read is number 30, The Reunion, which is, I believe, a Marco book, which deals with Visser 1.
I'm making the face I always make. But every book is so exciting.
It's true.
Yes, this one is really good.
Exactly. And we hit number 30, so we're into another round of 10 of books. There's only 50. We're halfway. We're crawling straight to the finish line. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this somewhat dense conversation about time travel and historical events. If you have anything to add or anything you would like to contribute to the conversation, we'd be happy to field any asks, either through text or if we might fire up Skype again and hash out some conversation like a conversation actually is hashed out. So thank you again, and we'll talk with you again soon.